week of March 24th, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 442, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
Did we really start with episode number one?
Yes, we did.
Good
we did
God. Start with good yes. God. In New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Well, hello, Michael.
How many kids do you have, Sperling?
I have two.
Where
would
are they
like
going?
One? I've got extra. I've got
where
extra.
Are they going to college?
I don't know. Wherever I donate, about $70.
So $70. Good luck. So Dr. Dre, I thought it was kind of amusing when it happened. He said, hey, my daughter got into school. You know, we didn't even bribe anyone. I thought that was, you know, he's proud of his daughter. She got into USC. Hard work and all that, obviously. Wealth and privilege and all that. But, you know, hey, I thought that was kind of amusing. Then people pointed out, you and Jimmy Iovine donated like $70 million to USC. Which, the remarkable thing about this to me is that he either, like, he forgot that he donated $70 million or didn't think it would make a difference. Like, oh, you think that would influence them? And whatever way you think about it, if you want proof that we're in a new gilded age, this to me, all right, I gave $70 million to USC. I forgot about that. Is that big money? Would they think that's a lot of money? Just, it blows my mind.
Yeah, I mean, I saw that too. And when I saw that, I thought, well, maybe it was because he did it with other people that he forgot. You know, he did it with Jimmy Iovine, and it was like a whole big like building of these this new school.
It's $70 million.
It's $70 million. Did it. Yeah, and I don't know how, you know, how, I don't know.
He forgot. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Just the whole thing. I was like, wow, really? Are you that jaded that you don't think that helping a school launch a new educational program would actually maybe influence them letting your daughter in? Are you that kind of
out of touch?
I don't know.
Out
yeah,
of touch.
Exactly. Thank you. Out of touch.
He needs,
couldn't think of the right word.
Well,
that's
he needs
it, out of
to
touch.
Get in touch. And to do that, he needs to listen to Showbiz Sandbox. And to do that, he'll find out if you tell him what's on the show this week.
This week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're staying out of the battle royale between writers and seemingly everyone else. One open letter supporting the WGA suggests there may be divisions even in the guild over this fight. Meanwhile, Cinemia seems to be following MoviePass by choking off the ability of its customers to actually use the service. Is this the end of movie subscriptions? No, it's not. During our sexual misconduct section, we look at whether Warner Brothers fired CEO Kevin Sugihara in part to woo J.J. Abrams. On Inside Baseball, we discuss Apple's underwhelming media event launching Apple TV+. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's headlines.
Wait, actually,
the weekend's box office. Forget the headlines. Just give us the numbers.
The box office is always the headlines at Hollywood. And the number one movie around the world is Captain Marvel. $87 million on the weekend, $910 million worldwide. Without bothering with what records it's broken or where it sits on the all-time list, let's just wait for it to pass $1 billion and see where it ends up, because this sucker is a monster.
Yeah, Captain Marvel is not the news this week. It's us. It's you and me.
No, I think Captain Marvel is the news, but yes, right behind it at number two is the Jordan Peele film, Us. $86 million on its opening weekend, or really $87 million if I round up another $50,000. So a great opening weekend for a movie that cost $20 million to make, reportedly. Good reviews. I saw it. I was pretty indifferent to it. Not as good as Get Out, which I did not love as much as other people, but I am not a horror person. But
Get Out, really?
Yeah, but seriously, did you see this movie?
I have not. No, I was in New York all weekend watching plays.
It makes absolutely no sense. No.
Oh, okay.
Zero.
Well.
Zero. And anybody trying to pretend it has some sort of social underlying message, give me a break. No, it doesn't. It really doesn't. It's nonsense. But it's decently made. It's got a good cast. There's some fun stuff, especially early on, but not a good movie. You were in New York seeing theater. Very cool. That's right. I forgot all about that. But you came and you left without seeing me because we exist only online.
That's right. We actually, we don't know whether we're real or whether we're just, you know, artificial intelligence.
It's been a decade. It's been a decade since I've seen you in person.
I think that's probably true. Actually, that might be true.
Yeah. Well, you know, we can always go to the movies. We can always talk about them. At number three around the world is More Than Blue, That's the Taiwanese Weepy. It's a remake of the Korean film of the same name. It's tearing it up in China. $30 million on the weekend, $136 million worldwide. And number four is the Teen Weepy, 5 Feet Apart. $15 million on the weekend. That's at $32 million. And the reported budget for that film is $7 million. So they are already well in the black. At number five around the world is Wonder Park, the Paramount film they're hoping to launch a TV series off of. $14 million on the weekend. It's at $40 million worldwide and trending poorly. At number six is How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World, the final in that trilogy. That's just under $500 million worldwide. So it's slowing down a bit. I think it's opened up in almost every territory. Maybe it has one to go, you know, like Japan, some decent territory where they could get good box office. But this is going to end up right between $500 and $600 million, just like we predicted. At number seven is a Chinese film. It's Song of Youth. It, from the trailer, it looks to me like it's a drama about college students in the 1980s and a beloved teacher. That made $11 million on its opening weekend. At number eight is a Korean drama. It's Money. It's about a young stockbroker caught up in scams. Isn't that redundant if you're a young stockbroker? $10 million on its opening weekend. And at number nine is Green Book, the Oscar-winning film. That looks like it's going to hit $300 million worldwide. Right now, it's at $293 million and counting, thanks to China. That's where it's making money now. It's in 68 territories, but most of the $8 million it made this weekend came in China. The same is true for our number 10 film, Bohemian Rhapsody. $7.6 million on the weekend. It's at $890 million worldwide. It opened in China, and apparently in China, it's a short. It's about 30 minutes long because they have cut all references to Freddie Mercury being gay and all references to Freddie Mercury getting AIDS. It's all been scrubbed out of the film.
Well, yeah, I don't know how you actually do that then.
Well, that's exactly what they did. It must make the film incoherent. And I wonder artistically why they would allow that. I wonder why they wouldn't just say, you know what? You don't want to show the film? That's fine, but we're not showing it in your country.
Money.
No, but that's, but the actors and the people involved, I would be like, what are you talking about? That's ridiculous. I don't want my film shown in a country where you cut out 30 minutes and remove the entire point of the film. I think that's an insult.
I don't think the actors have any say.
Well, yeah, but you want to work with Rami Malek on his next movie? You want to piss him off by destroying the movie he made? It's like taking Green Book and taking out the black characters. You know, come on. this is an insult to the talent that's involved. God knows the director is off to the side for various reasons. But it is an insult to the people who made the movie just to make a couple extra bucks. What's the point? And I think I would be very angry if I was one of those talent involved. And I would be pissed at Fox for selling it off like this and butchering the film just to open up in a territory. You want to see our film? Show our film. You don't want to show it? That's fine. But we're not going to destroy the film just so you can, you know, keep things quiet.
Well, I don't think that Fox has anything to...
Yes, they say no. You can't have it.
I don't think they were worried, basically. I think they were saying, hey, take the movie. We don't care if anybody works with us again, because let's face it, 3,000 of us are losing our jobs anyway.
Fair enough. Moving down the list, looking for some new films. I think this movie is a Dutch film. It's the Dutch word for prey. It's called Prooi, and it made $5.8 million on its opening weekend, but I could find out nothing about that film. Scrolling down further for some new movies, at number 15 is So Long, My Son. It's a Chinese drama about a young man and a woman. They're friends as kids, then they drift apart. We follow their lives, but it's got a lot of critical acclaim. It won Best Actor and Best Actress at the Berlin Film Festival. So the two leads are quite good, and it made $3.6 million on its opening weekend. Bumblebee opened up somewhere. I don't know where, but it made $2 million over the weekend, and it's at $462 million. Thank you for that extra $2 million. Worldwide. So $460 million worldwide for Bumblebee. That's well over triple its budget. So there may damn well be a sequel after all. This movie started slowly, didn't get a great sort of bump, but ultimately when you look back at the worldwide box office, it did quite well.
The sequel would be Bumblebees.
Right. I mean, it's clearly not a patch on what Transformers were doing, but if you keep the budget low, you're making money, keep it going. Why not? And I think scrolling down here, here's two more films. And number 23 is Balkansky Rubish, The Balkan Line. It's a Russian propaganda, a Russian film about brave Russians seizing an airport in Kosovo during the UN bombing of Yugoslavia, thus saving hostages from an evil Albanian warlord looking to harvest their organs. That's a lot going on. But this Russian action in Kosovo was extremely controversial at the time. And this film is not controversial at all as far as Russians are concerned. And it made $1.5 million on its opening weekend. That UK film Fisherman's Friends is chugging along. That's at $4.5 million. Those are the a cappella singing fishermen. And then at number 25, one more new film. It's Operation Goldfish. This is an Indian propaganda, Indian thriller about a dispute over Kashmir with Pakistan. A famous incident in India and Pakistan, presumably. And it made $1.4 million this weekend. It's at $4.5 million worldwide. So we missed it when it opened up last weekend. But that rounds out our international box office.
Well, now, speaking of international box office, and I should have said this at the head of the show, but there won't be a show next week. And why, you might be asking? Because next week is CinemaCon, the world's largest trade show for cinema operators. But the reason I mention all of that is usually right ahead of CinemaCon, the MPAA and all of the world cinema bodies, they start to release information. And the information this year and almost every year is about box office and how many theaters there are and how many screens there are. North American box office hit $11.9 billion, much as we had suspected. Attendance was up 5%. That is the most important thing for me.
Well, that's attendance a very rough estimate because it's only based on taking the average ticket price and dividing it by the total gross.
Right.
I wish to God we could have actual attendance numbers, and I don't know why they can't anonymize them. Say, MPA should just say, hey, you all have to send in the data. Just send it in. We'll anonymize it so nobody knows which chain is which, and we'll put it all together to get actual admission figures. It's ridiculous to do this half-assed estimate, but that's just me.
Well, and international revenue dipped about 1%, and that's in large part due to currency fluctuations. And really, in certain mature markets like Germany, attendance was down, and in other mature markets, attendance flatlined. So there's that issue. In China, of course, it hit $9 billion.
Right.
Japan, $2 billion.
And that's UK. China is the number one international market, $9 billion. Number
right.
two international market, way down there at $2 billion is Japan. I mean, given the size of the country, they're punching above their weight. But boy, that's a big jump. America's at $12 billion, China's at $9 billion, and then you go way down to Japan at $2 billion. UK is third internationally at $1.7 billion. So you can see there's a big drop-off after North America and China. I always wonder where India is when that country gets going economically and there are more people with more money. That's going to become a really big powerhouse as well. So the worldwide box office, of course, is $41.1 billion, led by the growth in North America and to a degree by China. So, wow. You know, that's a lot of money. It's two really big markets. China is catching up, but it's still, you know, 33% behind North America. So it's got a ways to go.
Well, and if you think about 25% of what is made in China gets to come back to, or gets to be, I guess what I'm
trying
to say is,
Hollywood studios get 25% of the gross.
Of whatever they make, correct. So while $9 billion may not have been U.S. movies or Hollywood movies, I should say.
But if $5 billion was, they got about $1 billion or $1.3 billion out of it.
Correct. That's right. Thank you for actually trying to do the math for me.
You're welcome. I want to do the math on who's actually going to the movies. This is interesting info. In the United States, who goes most often? Apparently, per capita, the people who go most frequently are 12 to 24-year-olds. They go to 5.1 movies a year. So that's a lot of movie going. If you go to five movies a year, you're right in there. So that's, you know, obviously, there are people way above that and people below that in the 12 to 24 range. But so there's some people going to a movie a month, two movies a month. That'd be a ton of movies. But 12 to 24, so they're going the most to the movies. So when you talk about, hey, attendance is up and the people going the most to the movie per capita are 12 to 24-year-olds, you know, this is supposed to be the group that doesn't care anymore. They're watching movies on their phone. They're playing video games. No, no. They're still the biggest movie-going segment of the U.S. population.
Well, and you mentioned last week that people don't watch movies on their phones. Meanwhile, while I was on the subway, I saw so many people watching movies on their phones.
Movies?
And they all...
You saw that they were watching?
Yes.
You walked up to them and stared at them and said,
well,
what are
no,
you
looking
at?
They sit next to you and you watch. You look at
what
they're watching.
Because I look at people all the time, and most of the time they're watching TV shows or they're watching clips or whatever. I rarely see people watching movies, but
I saw two television shows mm-hmm. and two movies. Now, this is purely anecdotal.
Right, but who are the movies?
Actually, they were Netflix movies, and one was that Ben Affleck war movie that's
Triple Threat or whatever.
Yeah, and another was another Netflix film. I think it was Bird Box, actually.
There you go. Well, we'd love to get those.
And I remember seeing what's remarkable to me is that they were all on the subway. They all had closed caption turned on, I guess because you can't hear it certain times.
Oh, yeah, it gets very loud in the subway, even with your headphones on. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, so that's, you know, people are watching stuff. They are spending money in the home for stuff. Global home entertainment, which I think in this case counts as TV subscriptions and DVD and Blu-ray rentals and streaming services. I think that's what they mean when they say, well, not everything, because I don't think they're not counting video games.
No.
They're not counting music. Right.
No.
So global home entertainment involves movies and TV and streaming services and stuff like that. And cable subscriptions, does it include that?
No, it does not.
Well, it does actually. Because
are you serious?
That's internet, global home. Global home entertainment is $55 billion. Worldwide box office and home entertainment combined, which this report from Variety or whatever detailed, includes cable, streaming, physical and digital sales and rentals, is almost $100 billion. It's $96 billion.
Okay, that makes sense.
Okay, and the worldwide number of screens is 190,000. There are 190,000 movie screens worldwide. With 8 billion people, it's not so many.
No, it's a certain number of screens per person, and I'm not going to do the math for you.
So that's a lot of numbers. What do you take away from all that? I take away the fact that, hey, in the U.S., young people go into the movies.
Hey, that's actually the best news I've heard in a while.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard any good news about the WGA talks?
Not a thing. No, actually, I've been, every time I hear WGA, I plug up my ears and I go, la, 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 la. I just don't want to hear it. And I'm kidding, of course.
Do you do that with global warming as well? Like, I don't want to hear about it. Call me in 30 years when it's up to our neck.
Hey, I am a citizen of the United States, and our dear leader says there is no such thing as global warming, so I must say, yeah. Anyway, of course, I'm kidding, so don't write in. I'm joking around about the WGA just because so much news has been coming out about the WGA.
Well, it just seems a lot of back and forth, a lot of tit for tat. They're talking, they're meeting, and they're releasing statements to try to undercut each other or make their point. And win the media war, I guess is the way to put it. David Simon certainly comes out swinging. Who was our guest we had last week?
What are you talking about? Jonathan Handel?
Yes, Jonathan Handel. I was saying, introducing Jonathan Handel, who is a contributing editor at Hollywood Reporter. I think I have the right title, don't I?
Yes, you do.
Yes, I do. And he made some great points. And he also said, hey, you know, the WGA is announcing these writers and the problems they've had, but a lot of them are anonymous. Well, that makes sense because, you know, you've got to do business with these people. But David Simon is not anonymous. He came out swinging against his own agents at CAA. He says, I'm the creator of The Wire and Tremé, and he has blasted CAA. He says HBO packaged his book Homicide and represented both CAA, I mean. Packaged his book Homicide and represented both sides of the rights sale without his knowledge or consent. Homicide is by far the biggest hit of David Simon's career, and CAA handled his deal with director Barry Levinson, whom they also represented. He says packaging fees are corrupt. Quote, packaging is a lie, he wrote on his personal blog. Quote, it is theft. It is fraud. In the hands of the right U.S. attorney, it might even be prima facie evidence of decades of racketeering. It's that effing ugly. It's corrupt. You know,
I don't know what the packaging fees are these days, so I can't speak to what modern packaging fees are. I do know that as a packaging agent, the whole goal was to get a writer, a director, an actor. You basically want to bundle up a project so that all these people are working, right? And then
From your company.
Right.
Or, and you want to place it with the place where your company, CAA, is going to get the best deal. Your concern is not doing the best thing for the writer. Your concern is doing the best thing for CAA, which means you have a conflict. Which means if CAA gets a better deal with this network and your writer wants to go with that network, you're going to either lie to him and say, oh, they turned us down, or you're just not going to make it. You're going to play hardball and screw over that deal so you can get it over there. Even if they'd rather be at, say, HBO rather than FX. You're going to go to FX because you got a better, you know, rep with them, and therefore you're going to get a better deal. You have a conflict of interest, which brings up my point about Jonathan Handel. He made a good point about, hey, there's always conflicts of interest. And I knew there was something I was trying to get my head around, and I think it's this. Yes, there's always conflicts of interest with all these different areas. And if you're a writer and you've got a show and you're going to say, you know, Fox, and they're going to produce your show, they're going to be the studio making your show, they may then also be the network that airs your show. They may also be the cable channel, FX, that syndicates your show. They may also own a piece of Hulu that's going to stream your show. And those are all conflicts of interest. However, your relationship with Fox, even though they're picking up your show and hiring you, is adversarial. You don't ever imagine that they are on your side. You always know that they want to pay you as little as possible so they can make as much as possible. So you have a reason to be wary of them every step of the way. They are not your friend. However, your agent should damn well be your friend. Why wouldn't he be your friend? You hired him to represent you. He's supposed to be on your side. So when he has conflicts of interest and you're supposed to be able to trust that he actually is doing what's best for you, that's why I think that relationship is very different from the adversarial one you have with all these other people who also have conflicts of interest.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. I do not know what modern packaging fees are. A lot of them, when I was working in the agency business, were all very standard. So it didn't matter whether you were at NBC or CBS because the fee was going to be the same.
That's not true anymore. Certainly not true anymore. If it ever, that's not true.
With syndication,
they constantly
talk
about agents screwing over their clients and taking it to a different outlet and not even telling them they had an offer from another outlet because they wanted to go somewhere else because they were going to get a better deal. Those are the stories that we're hearing from the WGA time and time again.
Yeah, if that's happened,
it's absolutely happened. There's no doubt about it.
First of all, it's just stupid, and here's why. That truth always comes out. It's just there's too many emails going back and forth. There's too many records of phone calls where, you know, it's not even a he said, she said thing. You just look at the records and you go, well, actually, NBC came in at a higher level. Here's the proof of that. I mean, it's just
Well, it doesn't come out eventually. People have to sue to find out if their show made a profit. It takes decades for the truth to come out. So it doesn't always come out. They don't find out. David Simon obviously did not find out for years what happened on his thing, that they were double dealing him and he didn't get the best deal he should have. And so he's
well,
angry.
But he did know that CA represented Barry Levinson. That he did know.
There were other parts of it he didn't know. He did not know all sorts of things going on with this deal. That's why he's so furious. Don't tell him he knew. He didn't know. They represented both sides of his rights sale without his knowledge or consent. That's what he says.
Okay, well, you know, they knew. I would imagine he knew that they were packaging.
He says they represented both sides of the rights sale without his knowledge or consent. So,
but what are both sides in this case?
Who the hell knows? It doesn't matter. He's saying they represented both sides without his knowledge or consent. We don't need to get into the details. He's saying that's what happened. Who cares what it is? He said they sold my book to they were representing the buyer and the seller at the same time. That is not going to get David Simon
the best deal.
And he didn't know that was happening. And he's pissed.
So here's what he's saying. And he's
Well, I understand what he's saying.
We all
understand. You're the only one who doesn't understand. You don't need to explain it to us. We already know.
Well,
it's wrong.
Obviously, I didn't, which means somebody might not. What he's saying is our agents were representing Barry Levinson. Fine. They were representing me. Fine, they were representing the sale of the book. Fine. However, by accepting a packaging fee, you're also technically representing the producer and or buyer. So that's, and then in that regard, he is correct.
Well, a lot of big writers signed a statement in support of the WGA and the stance that they are taking right now. There are a lot of big names, and there are big names on both sides of the debate. Apparently, a lot of big names didn't sign this letter of statement. So that seems to indicate to a lot of people, hey, guess what? Is J.J. Abrams on the list? Is Shonda Rhimes on the list? And everybody's seen this person's on and that person's off rather than getting into who's who and where. The point is, a lot of big names did not sign this letter of statement supporting the WGA, either because they didn't know about it or they don't support it. And maybe they're not excited by what's going on or they think it's being handled poorly. It seems like there might be a major split because there were a lot of names missing from that statement. And so talks are ongoing. And they're raucous, and who knows where this is going to end up, but it looks scary.
You know what also looks scary, and we have no idea where it's going to end up, is any sexual misconduct news, frankly.
That's right. J.J. Abrams came up in the WGA talks, and he also comes up in the story about the firing of Warner Brothers CEO, Kevin...
Susihara.
Yes. In fact, though, I got an emails and text saying, you're not saying that name right.
It's Sugihara.
Really? Sugihara.
Okay.
Sugihara, right. Jihara, like it looks. And in fact, I got chided as well. So my joke is that Kevin Tsujihara and Neil deGrasse Tyson walk into a bar. And Neil says, hey, Kevin, how do I say your last name? And Kevin says, well, it's Tsujihara. And he says, hey, were you on that Canadian show about kids in high school? He's like, no, 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 I was not on Degrassi. That's an entirely different show. My name is Neil deGrasse Tyson. So I apologize to both of those men for getting their names wrong. It ain't easy. We try, we look up video, and sometimes we get it wrong. But anyway, Kevin, of course, was dumped by Warner Brothers after admitting that he used his position of power to trade sex for an opportunity to audition and get roles.
He didn't.
Yes, he did.
To help an actress.
No, he traded sex to get her roles. He gave, right. He had sex with her and then in return gave her opportunities to audition and get roles on movies and TV shows.
Correct.
Right. Yes. And then he lied to his studio when they found out, heard rumors about it, and he lied to them. Now he's been fired. One extra wrinkle is that J.J. Abrams, one of the biggest talents around, a big movie person, a big TV person, making lots of shows, he's being wooed by one and all as his contract is up at Warner Brothers, and they want to keep him. And his co-CEO, Katie McGrath, she's the co-CEO of Bad Robot. She's also the co-founder of Time's Up, and she's also his wife. And she made clear to them that keeping Tsujihara on was definitely a values issue that they would take into consideration when making their decision. What happened next? Goodbye, Kevin.
Yeah.
It's just one more, you know, when you're weighing your decision, it is certainly, if this happened, one more factor in its favor. It's not like they got him fired as such, but it's certainly something that you're going to take seriously.
Yeah. I mean, I always wonder, it's like, did you get fired for the crime or for lying to cover it up? And in a way, I think probably the latter in this case.
Well, I don't know. I think it was a big deal that he traded sex for auditions. You know, it's so common that we may just roll our eyes and go, yeah, doesn't that happen all the time? Yes, it does. And maybe not anymore.
Well, you mentioned the word big and deal together. So did it I? Must be time. Yes, you did. So it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Disney gobbled up a big chunk of 20th Century Fox, and as expected, heads began to roll. The merger was years in the making, and so was the bloodbath. While many jobs lost, all of these jobs that will be lost will be in areas like accounting.
Not all of them.
Yeah, true. But, you know, accounting, marketing, distribution, some big names fell as well. Fox employees were described as shell-shocked, and some estimates say more than 4,000 jobs in all will be lost. That's a merger for you. What else did you think was going to happen? Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I feel a little insensitive because I was seeing headlines and they were saying as people were being fired the day after or the day of the merger becoming official, people were fired left and right. And they said employees were shell-shocked and they were stunned and they were amazed. And I thought, why? I mean, what did you think was going to happen?
Internally and both at Disney and at Fox, except for at very high levels, Stacey Snyder, they said, look, we don't need two heads of a studio. Okay, so Alan Horn can handle everything. And I think Stacey Snyder did not want to go to Disney. I think
was no way they were going to maintain two accounting departments or two marketing departments. There's no way they're going to have duplication of services. That's one reason you merge. You can save money. There's no way anybody could have actually thought in accounting and marketing, oh, I'm sure they'll keep us entirely independent and separate. People are going to lose their jobs. That's what always happens every single time. And if they lied to you and said, oh, we won't fire you. Are you kidding me?
Well, here's the thing. One of the things they didn't say was, we're basically going to fold 20th Century Fox. They said, we don't know whether we're going to keep 20th Century Fox as a separate label.
But they're still going to fire thousands of people. Whatever they do with the shingle, they're still going to fire a ton of people. There's no way they're maintaining it entirely separately the way it is. That's what happens when you merge. If people were misled or somehow convinced themselves, I'm sure my job would be fine. Oh, God, I feel sorry for you. But, you know, I hope you got a good severance package. And I'm sorry to be insensitive, but I cannot believe that they were surprised that thousands of people are going to lose their job. Of course they are. That's why mergers like this are such a bad thing. We have one less big player, one less big studio, less competition, fewer jobs, and Disney gets bigger and bigger. It's not good for the industry and it's not good for the country.
Well, and I think that, I heard somebody say, oh, come on, all those guys, they're going to find other jobs. And,
everybody
gets fired or laid off eventually in Hollywood. And, you know, they just wind up getting replaced or some other job, you know, wind up in some other job. And my comment back was, well, in this case, the job literally went away. Like, there is, there. It's not like there's someplace else for them to land.
No, yeah.
That people... job is now gone. There used to be 6 heads of distribution. There will now be 5.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, but that's saying, just
everybody
the
gets fired and you'll find a job is tell it to coal country. Sometimes yeah. jobs are gone and you have to leave and uproot yourself to find another job that probably doesn't pay as well.
Well, and, you know, it's funny. I had a client that asked me, who should I be talking to at Fox? I just sent an email to Chris Aronson.
Who the hell knows?
Today. And it was, I said, look at your calendar. And they said, what do you mean? I said, look at your calendar. What day is it? March 20th. I said, yeah, you shouldn't be talking to anybody at 20th Century Fox right now because they literally just today at midnight got subsumed by Disney and they're all waiting for the black, you know, SUVs to pull up from Burbank to find out who gets fired. And they said, well, Chris Aronson said
that. So you weren't surprised that lots of people were fired. I don't know why anyone else would be.
Yeah, well, everybody was waiting to find out what's going to happen next.
They fire people. It's what always happens. They fire people. I don't understand. Who the hell would think anything else?
Sure enough, the very next day, everybody wound up getting fired. Everybody that they were talking to wound up getting fired.
Move on.
Okay. Well, so anyway, you say it's not a big deal. I say
it's a big deal that 4,000 people are losing their jobs. Of course it is. I just can't believe anybody is surprised or was like, what? That just seems incredibly naive, especially for people working in Hollywood.
Well, Netflix is the home of shows found only on Netflix. Duh. But it wasn't so long ago that Netflix was the home of movies that had recently been in the movie theaters or TV shows like Friends or Grey's Anatomy. Actually, I believe it is still home to Friends.
Yeah.
Not anymore, though. In 2018, 51% of the content added to Netflix were Netflix originals. And 49% was content licensed from other providers. That's the first time a majority of viewing has been from Netflix itself. Indeed, 11%.
I'm sorry, the majority of content.
Okay, that's what I was worried. Yeah. 11% of the entire Netflix library available right now is made of Netflix originals. That's almost triple the amount than 2016 when Netflix originals like House of Cards and Orange is the New Black made up just 4%. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. So in 3 years, they have tripled the amount of original content in their entire library. They're over 10%. They're at 11%, and they're still building by leaps and bounds. So I'm imagining, you know, in another 3 years, they'll be at 15 or 20% of all their library stuff will be Netflix originals. That's a really interesting fact. And just shows how smart they were. They were, you know, sending DVDs by mail. They pivoted to streaming. And then they said, you know what? We're spending all this money and all these libraries to license them. And they can just keep raising the amount to charge us. And they're going to start their own services. We better do something. And they started making original content. Those are three very different businesses. And they've done them all very well. So full credit to them.
Even with the little speed bump and hiccup they had regarding that whole, like, whatever they were going to call themselves.
Oh, right, right. Yeah, that doesn't even matter. And they are experimenting in India with a half-price plan. So in India, they're saying if you just want to watch content on a mobile device, a single mobile device like your phone or tablet, we'll charge you half of what we charge you for your regular monthly fee. And people are picking it up. So they're recognizing that this is, you know, there's a lot of different parts of the world. A lot of different price points are comfortable for people. There are people just watching on their mobile device. And if they just use one, let's say, all right, we'll give you a standard definition, just one mobile device. We won't charge you as much. I think it's a good plan.
Are pre-ads the new pre-order? They certainly are at Apple Music. The savvy website Music Business Worldwide is reporting that the debut album from 17-year-old Billie Eilish racked up 800,000 pre-ads on Apple Music more than a week before it drops on March 29th. Just as pre-ordering a book or CD or movie ticket reflects huge demand, pre-ads, as they're known, shows fans are so eager to check something out they want it pushed to their streaming service as soon as possible. The pre-ads for the album titled When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go? That's the name of the album, is an all-time record. That's impressive, but you can bet it will be surpassed multiple times before 2019 is done. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's a new way to measure popularity, and I'm sure it will continue to grow. You can follow people on Spotify, but as far as I know, even if I follow them, they don't quite push the new album as easily as possible. It's not like, oh, there you go. Here are all the albums that from people that you follow. They do tend to push music a little bit, but they could be better at it. I went to Spotify to say, hey, can I pre-add her new album? No, I cannot, but I can follow her. So we'll have to see how that works up. So that this tracks individual excitement for an individual album or single. Following an artist in general is also noteworthy. This is just how people get attention and making it as easy as possible for you to get the new music as soon as it's available.
Fans of C.S. Lewis's Narnia, rejoice!
Huzzah!
A new novel has been written by acclaimed author Frances Spufford. Other writers who've seen advanced copies, they love it and say it almost eerily captures the voice of Lewis. Set between the action in The Magician's Nephew and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the novel was written at the urging of Spufford's daughter. Unfortunately, we may have to wait until 2034 before anyone gets to read The Stone Table, and we can discover how the altar named in the title came to be or why four thrones of Narnia were empty in the first place. That's when the copyright on the Narnia books is set to expire. But wait! If trademark law holds sway, then we may never get to read it because trademarks can be renewed in perpetuity. It's perhaps one more reason copyright and trademark laws need to be brought up to date, unless you are in an heir to C.S. Lewis, in which case you may think the laws are working perfectly well. Thank you very much. Spufford felt compelled to write the book, but has reached out to the Lewis estate to make it an approved edition to the canon. I didn't know you could do that. As of yet, there has been no response. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. Of course, anybody can write anything, but you can't publish it unless you get approval from the estate when they have control. So this well-known author who's never written a children's book wrote the book. People like it, and he has reached out to the estate to say, hey, you know, can we talk about this? And they're, for some reason, have not even said no. They just haven't really responded to him yet. But it does bring up our old bugaboo about copyright and trademark. A lot needs to be cleaned up here. It's gone from something to help artists to something that is helping massive multinational corporations and stifling creativity to an absurd extreme.
Mickey Mouse disagrees. They said it wouldn't happen, but the CW show Supernatural is finally going to call it a day after a 15th and final season of 20 episodes airing during the 2019-2020 season. It stars Jared Padalecki of Gilmore Girls and Jensen Ackles of Days of Our Lives. They star as brothers who hunt down demons, ghosts, and other supernatural beasties. It is the longest-running sci-fi genre show in U.S. history. Pity it never made a profit. Big deal or big whoop?
Exactly. Oh, 15 years. Did great. Ran on and on. Never made any money. Too bad. Too bad about that.
Well, is it a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's been on for 1,000 years. I know people who will still be upset, but you know, it's had a good long run.
Everybody
who would have dreamt that Jared Padalecki would have the biggest hit coming out of Gilmore Girls? Not me.
Yeah, well,
more
that's...
than Milo Ventimiglia would be on 3 hit shows: Gilmore Girls, Heroes, and now This Is Us. That's crazy.
Well, and I'm sure Jared Padalecki is saying, "You can't cancel this. I'm never going to have this good a career."
He already has.
Yeah.
What are you talking about? He said, you know, people go their whole lives without something like that. Yeah, and Rory Gilmore had good taste in boyfriends.
Everybody is fighting for a bigger piece of the pie when it comes to streaming residuals. But musicians are still looking for their first slice. The American Federation of Musicians was frustrated again when negotiating with studios and film and TV producers. They agreed to a contract extension through November 14th that includes a 2% increase in scale minimums. What they wanted was the same thing directors and writers and actors get: streaming residuals. That's been a feature of the collective bargaining agreement of those other guilds since 2014, but musicians working in TV, film, and sound recording have been shut out. Given the fact that streaming is becoming so dominant, they've come up for a new word for musicians who can't get their fair share. They've been de-residualized. It's a word they hope will go away soon, but not this time. I hope it goes away soon because it's really hard to say.
Big deal or big whoop? I will say it is a big deal. What are they waiting for? They should have gone on strike 4 or 5 years ago when the other people got their breakthrough. There's nothing, you know, it's been 5 years. You haven't gotten it yet. You're going to have to strike. It's got to be important to you because this is where all the action is. This is where the money is. And if you're not getting a piece of that, you are out in the cold. Going on strike is scary, but they need to do it.
Is Cinemia dying? News spread over the weekend that virtually no one who subscribes to Cinemia, the movie-going subscription service, was able to buy a ticket this weekend. Anyone trying to use the app here in the United States was stuck in a spinning wheel of death. The company refused to say if it was having technical issues or the service was down, telling individual subscribers that the site was under maintenance on a weekend rather than, say, Monday morning, and they should delete the app and then download it again later. That didn't help, by the way. IndieWire also reported many annual subscribers complaining about being booted off the service. Cinemia says it was for fraud. That's why they got booted. They say, and these subscribers say, they were just using the service heavily and the company was losing money on them. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. I had a friend who suddenly Film Forum doesn't appear anymore. You can't even buy a ticket at Film Forum. So from saying you can go to any theater, suddenly they're making theaters black out and simply not appear. There's no way to do it. You've never been able to legally buy a ticket to a revival movie, whether it's at AMC, like Field of Dreams or Gone with the Wind that's been showing in the last few weekends, or at Film Forum. And now they simply just said you can't buy any ticket at all. This is exactly what happened with MoviePass. It's a very bad sign. I was about to take a gamble and buy an annual subscription for 3 movie tickets a month for $84, a flat $84 for the year. I figured, hey, if I see 6 movies, I'll break even because I live in New York. But now I'm too scared. I'm not going to do it. I don't trust them, just like it was with MoviePass. So I think it's a very big deal. And it looks like the end of movie subscriptions to me, at least for the time being. Why do you say it's not?
I have some inside information, which actually, as of today, there is now a third player. And full disclosure, I am working with this third player. They are a client of Covergent. So.
And when are they going to announce their deal or plan?
Well, they are working with the exhibitor. They plan on working directly with exhibitors and building a network of exhibitors that you could then go to. So you wouldn't have access to every single theater
chain.
Yeah, you would have access to those theater chains that are participating, much like a frequent flyer program. You know, you don't get miles for airlines that aren't a part of that program. Same concept.
It's not like airlines. It's like, is it a monthly pass where you pay a certain fee and you can go see as many movies as you want? Or is it three tickets a month? Or what is it?
Yeah, there are the plans have been...
Very early days, obviously. They've announced nothing.
No. They have. You can go to the website. Yeah, I think it's myinfinity.co.
Uh-huh.
And that's why I happen to know that they are launching today, in fact.
So movie going past done right. Ooh, that sounds familiar. Join the wait list. We're a subscription program of the cinemas, by the cinemas, for the people. One plan for all partner cinemas. Rollover tickets, no hidden fees, no physical cards to carry. Cards were all right. No kiosk-only transactions or sold-out shows. I don't know how they could do that. So what is the deal? Pick a cinema, select your movie, choose to pay with your thing. But, okay, solo, one ticket at a time. 2 tickets at a time, family, 4 tickets at a time. But what does it cost? They don't tell you a word about what it might cost.
Yeah, because they've got to work with exhibitors beforehand. So they're
or how many movies you can go see in a month or anything.
Again, they're working with exhibitors. I think it's going to wind up being 4 to 6 movies a month.
Well, that's a lot. The question, of course, is how much they're going to. So they haven't announced anything. They've just said, hey, give us your email, which I have just done.
Okay.
And so they are partnering with cinemas. So the question is how many cinemas, and obviously it'll be all the small ones at first.
I believe that's what will happen, yes.
No big chain is coming within a mile of this.
I don't believe that, and I think they're very open about saying that Regal, Cinemark, and AMC
have no interest.
Yeah, they're not going to have any interest, even though technically this could, you know, work with their loyalty programs as well.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. But again, until we know the details, we don't know if their plan makes any more sense financially than the others did. You know, $10 a month didn't work. $30 a month didn't work. It certainly doesn't seem to be working for Cinemia. We'll have to see if My Infinity can crack the nut. But it's interesting that smaller chains are still interested in this. Perhaps they saw a big increase in attendance and realized, hey, we can make money off popcorn and soda if we get more butts in the seat.
Yes, indeed.
All right.
But I do happen to know that it is your favorite time of year, Michael, when the Library of Congress adds 25 new sound recordings to the National Recording Registry. This year's honorees range from the earliest recordings of Yiddish songs from 1901 to Jay-Z's The Blueprint. In between, you'll find everything from Cab Calloway's single Minnie the Moocher or Cyndi Lauper's solo debut on which she sang that money changes everything. Pablo Casals. Pablo Casals performing Bach, a Bach set celebrating the Saturday morning educational shorts dubbed Schoolhouse Rock. An episode of the radio show Gunsmoke, the Richie Valens hit La Bamba, and monologues recorded by actress Ruth Draper are also in the mix. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I'm furious. It's a big whoop, because how could they not have included Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper's beautiful duet on Shallow?
Because it's too new?
I don't know. They might have a rule about waiting 10 years after a recording has been recorded. But no, it's very cool. We have a link in our show notes. And so a lot of these things, especially the obscure ones, you can listen to right away. And that's really neat. Like Bobby Kennedy's speech to a crowd after the assassination of MLK became public knowledge. That's pretty moving to listen to. You feel like you're right there in the midst of history. Neil Diamond's Sweet Caroline is in there for all sorts of fun pop cultural reasons. It's just a great mix of stuff. Fascinating to see. And it's kind of amazing. You click on a link and you're listening to a Yiddish song recorded in 1901. I still think that's like magic.
Well, first of all, it wasn't Yiddish when it was recorded. It was actually recorded in French, but the recording was so bad it now sounds like Yiddish.
Okay.
I'm kidding. Come on.
Be nice to your waitress. Yeah.
All jokes aside, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, we're talking about Apple. Apple, Apple, Apple. And we're not talking about the fruit. We're talking about the technology company. I mean, what is it these days? It's like it's an everything company.
Well, that's right. They're pivoting from hardware, which is still a huge part of their business, and it's where a lot of their money comes, to offering more and more services, in part because when they offer a good service like iTunes, that keeps people in the Apple family. So they're launching a bunch of new services, mostly add-ons to what they've already had in place, but some new stuff as well. I feel like we should go through them and say whether they were good or bad, and we'll end up with Apple TV, because that was the one we were most excited about and which had the least amount of information. I think It was kind of a disaster of a rollout. I've never watched one of these before, but it was exhausting. It felt like a TED talk where everybody was like, we're nurturing the world and touching souls. I don't know if I assume it's not like that when they're talking about AirPods, but
I hate to tell you this, Michael, but what you saw yesterday is indicative of how they roll out hardware.
But a lot of people said this was a really bad rollout compared to other ones. It was sloppy, not well done. Certainly the Apple TV section was a disaster, but that's my opinion.
They don't normally have the parade of stars. No, it's usually so many of the in-house Apple people coming out to demonstrate different technologies. But in this case, what they had to demonstrate were TV shows. They should have just shown clips.
Well, there's nothing wrong with having big stars on stage. The question is, why leave them sitting in the audience? But anyway, first up is Apple News. We now know some details. It will cost $10 a month. You'll get 300 magazines and newspapers, really big titles like The New Yorker, Atlantic Monthly, National Geographic, The LA Times, and The Wall Street Journal, among many, many others. If you have a family plan, it still costs $10 a month. Excuse me. I'm going to sneeze again. I hope you keep that in. Family plans still cost you $10 a month. So you, your wife, and your two daughters can all access newspapers and magazines for $10 a month. That's a really good deal, at least for consumers. The question is it a good deal for the magazines and the newspapers?
You know what the New York Times and Washington Post say to that question?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Well, but let's be clear here. First of all, we don't know whether they all get a flat fee or whether they get paid a small fat fee and then more, depending on how many people access their articles.
That has been announced. So Apple said, we are going to keep 50% of the $10.
Well, we know that.
And then the $5 will be split up among the people in the program based on usage. So, in other words, if everybody goes to National Geographic one month and
all 5 million. $5. Well, the interesting thing there is you can say, $5 is very little money to split among 300 newspapers and magazines. But guess what? They probably have 20,000, 80,000, 100,000 subscribers paying $20, $30, $40, $50 a year. But if you suddenly have 10 million people doing it, You know, that's the streaming of music. It's not necessarily a bad deal, especially for smaller publications that can maybe get access to people who wouldn't buy their subscription. But when they have access to it and it's free and they start to look at it and they start to love it. I love Atlantic Monthly. I love New Yorker. I love the others. I subscribe to almost nothing anymore. Do I spend $120 a year on subscriptions? No, I do not. And if I do spend that, it looks like a really good bargain to me, though.
I mean, if Vanity Fair is an Apple News... If
it is,
oh, then I might just cancel all my subscriptions. And is Variety?
No, I don't believe. I didn't see them, so I don't. I don't think they have trade stuff.
Oh, okay.
But maybe they. I think Billboard was in the mix.
Oh,
well actually, then, Billboard was. So maybe Variety and Hollywood Reporter are. I don't know.
Then you know, I would just cancel my subscriptions and just.
Right, but again, you've got like 50,000 people subscribing, or 80,000 people subscribing to the Hollywood Reporter, as opposed to 10 million people accessing it, and they're already accessing this some of this stuff online. I look at the New Yorker, and I don't subscribe to them. If I can do it all the time, they're going to get a chunk of $5 a month rather than a chunk of nothing.
Well, and keep in mind that they bought Texture. Apple did. Which was this exact program. So they basically
You didn't need to be a genius to know, just put a bunch of stuff together and charge a monthly bundle fee. That's not, Texture didn't invent that.
No, but I'm just kind of.
But they all have to repurpose their stuff so it looks good on the phone. That's a lot of work. But again, they're probably already doing that anyway, because that's where people are reading these articles. So I don't, you know, you're giving up a lot of control. Apple's getting half of the money. I don't think it's necessarily, I'm not saying, oh, is this wonderful for them? But maybe it will work out long term because, hey, I'm not buying a lot of magazines right now, but it may be worth my money to spend $10 a month and have access to all of these because there's a lot of good magazines in that mix. What about the Apple Card? Will you get that?
No, I'm not. And I think we should skip over because it has nothing to do with entertainment whatsoever.
It doesn't, and it's a disaster, and the APR rates are really high. They're partnered with Goldman Sachs. There's a lovely company to do business with.
Let's just skip it and move on to Apple TV, because that's really what we're here
Apple Arcade.
Apple Arcade, okay, so it's basically Steam, okay? That's basically what we've got here.
It's a monthly subscription service to access video games.
Right, that's Steam.
Well, it's not
that's Xbox Steam. Live. That's
but except these are all unique to them. They're not available anywhere else.
Correct.
And to me, the bizarre thing here is they want, you know, hardcore gamers are the people who will spend monthly fees on subscribing to gaming, right? But all their games seem to be not traditional games, as if, you know, they're lovely, they're touchable, they're humanity filled, they're all these non-gaming type games, to which I say, well, that seems like it appeals to people who aren't hardcore gamers, which aren't the people who are going to want to subscribe to it. So nothing wrong with it. 100 games, get some great reviews. But it seems a hard lift to get people to yet another service, and you're only getting 100 games. I don't know if that's a few or a lot compared to Steam. You could tell me more about that.
I couldn't tell you. I'm not a big gamer, so.
Right. Well, it's a big business. More money being spent on video games than going to the movies. So, you know, don't discount it. And they've got a lot of big names making games for them. Some of them look pretty damn cool. And all the way through, they were emphasizing privacy, privacy, privacy. That certainly was the case here as well. But the final thing is Apple TV.
I would love to tell you about it. Here's what I can tell you. Steven Spielberg talked about it, and Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon talked about it, and Jamil Nanjiani talked about it. I couldn't tell you anything about it because basically there's going to be a bunch of shows and a bunch of stuff on a TV thing and no price. No price whatsoever. That's all we cared about.
Well, first of all, it's not a bunch of shows. We heard about virtually nothing new other than what we already knew about. We had a presentation of 6 shows, all of which we were aware of. That's about 40 hours worth of content. You could watch that in 3 days. You know? So it's like, wow, you know, getting people to spend a monthly fee to access, you know, 10 shows, 20 shows. That's, you know, are they going to have libraries of stuff?
Well, they said they'd have access to Spectrum, DirecTV,
No, you got to pay for that. No, you don't have access. You got to pay for that.
Right,
that's not access.
Thing.
No, Apple TV Plus is separate from Apple TV.
Oh, okay. Apple TV basically, yeah, they're doing away with the set-top boxes, basically.
But it's a joke. It's a joke. They're like, oh, look, you can access YouTube and Fandango and Amazon Prime right on our thing. Well, I can do that now on my smart TV. They're like, it's all in one place. Well, I literally can do that right now. And they said, we're going to have a la carte TV channels. No, they're not. What they're having is the channels that people can already get a la carte, like Stars and BritBox and CBS All Access and HBO Now.
Well, yeah, the one thing that is, I want to say ingenious, since somebody was going to do it, is that you don't have to switch in between the different apps that as you do now. Like, oh, I have to go to the HBO Go app. Oh, I have to go to the Netflix app. Oh, the whole concept is, oh, you just stay and you... You know, the software.
Well, I think you have to change channels just like you do.
Yes,
I don't understand the difference here, because on my thing, it's not some big elaborate thing. They're all listed together on my smart TV, and I click on Amazon Prime when I want to watch that show. They may do a better job of presenting the information available, like maybe. Just watch, I guess. But to me, I don't see the difference. And the idea that they're offering a la carte is BS, because what people mean when they say a la carte means I want to be able to get ABC, CBS, NBC, PBS, ESPN, CNN, and four other things a la carte for like a dollar each. That's not what they're offering. They're offering absolutely nothing new in terms of a la carte that everybody else offers already right now. So to me, that was a big nothing burger.
And what about Apple TV Plus?
Plus.
Plus what? Plus how much is it going to cost? That's what I want to know.
What a horrible presentation. So boring, so badly done. Celebrities trotted out, and they all just sort of sit around and, you know, try to be fun. It was just flat and awful. They had a ton of celebrities sitting in the audience. They kept cutting to Chris Evans, and people were texting, he sure looks bored. Like, why did they not bring all the stars on stage? Why did they have them sitting in darkness watching the event? Why wouldn't you bring them all out to have one big, hey, look at everybody on stage?
They had to have time for Oprah.
Well, yes. At the end, he said, but we have one more voice we haven't heard from. One more voice that matters more than any other. And I thought he was going to say you and be like some sort of new Apple offering of like consumer created content like YouTube. But no, he said one more voice, Oprah. So it's like, and what did she offer? She says, I'm going to do a documentary film, which means 2 hours of content. I'm doing a multi-part documentary film about mental health. So maybe 8 hours of content. So we're talking about 10 hours of content from Oprah. That'll be watched in a day. And then what are you going to do for the rest of the month? The one thing that people will actually be excited by in the publishing world is that she said she's going to do her book show on there, offer a book of the month, tout it, interview the author on an Amazon, Apple platform, have it streamed out to the world. And, you know, since her show's gone, they've had Oprah picks and stuff on the magazine. But with her in front of it and interviewing the author and beating the drum again, that might really, you know, reignite it. And so in the publishing world, they're like, great, I hope Oprah picks my book and is touting it like she used to do, because that could really be a big mover of books. But as far as TV's concerned, I thought it was a disaster. Why have a big event?
Because they do that for everything. As far as TV concerned, I'm almost tempted to say they got up there, they said, you know, here's what we're thinking of, but watch this space, we'll fill you in more.
No. The point is to do it in the fall when you can actually give some info. I don't know why you had the event now, because the Apple TV stuff is a joke, and if it is better, they sure as hell didn't explain it well enough for me to understand why it was an improvement on what I can do right now on my smart TV. And Apple TV Plus was less than a joke. It was boring. They didn't bring everybody up on stage like any moron knows to do a Comic-Con, and it was flat and dull and uninteresting. So, you know, vague, you know, references to shows we haven't heard yet, and we still don't know what it's going to cost. It was ridiculous. You're not ready. Don't do it. If you're not ready to promote it, don't waste our time and say something's going to happen. Come back in the fall.
Yeah, but you know what? I would tell you that Steve Jobs stood up on stage and said, I have this iPhone in my hand, and you won't be able to get it for another 6 months. And it worked just fine.
It works fine for something that's new and going to be so much better than what anybody else has offered. That, you know, that works once in a lifetime. But you say, I've got a TV show coming out starring with a big star in it. Big effing deal. Everybody has big TV shows with big stars in it. You know, tell us something that we don't hear every day from every other channel and streaming service. So, no, you're not impressing me by saying I've got a TV show with Reese Witherspoon. I'm looking forward to seeing it, but that's not like saying I have an innovative new product that no one has ever seen before that kicks the ass of every other iPhone in the world. Apple TV Plus, there's no reason on God's green earth anybody's going to pay $10 a month to have access to 20 shows. You know, that's what they're going to offer? That's all we seem to know right now. If they don't have a big library of content to offer, who the hell is going to give them money like that? I don't get it.
Not me.
Not me.
And certainly not Michael Lynne.
Yes, the co-chair and CEO of New Line. He died at 77. More of a numbers guy and a business guy, I think, than a creative end of the show. But, you know, he joined them in the early 80s by bumping into his college pal, Bob Shea, on the street. Bob said, hey, come be my in-house counsel. Help me with this. And it went on from there. They turned New Line from a struggling entity to a powerhouse. They were gobbled up by Turner and then, of course, Time Warner. They had big franchises like Nightmare on Elm Street, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and then they rolled the dice on The Lord of the Rings. $360 million for three films, all shot at once. That was a crazy, crazy gamble, and they could have ended up with The Golden Compass. And
yeah, well, I was going to say, you know, they did shoot The Golden Compass, didn't they? Yeah, and that's what killed them.
That's one of the things that didn't help for sure. But yeah, so that was a huge roll of the dice, and boy, did it pay off. So, you know, he's a big part of Hollywood for a number of years.
And then singer Scott Walker died at the age of 76. He is a star both in the U.S. and in the U.K.
Well, really not in the U.S. at all. He was really well known in the U.K.
Really? You don't think anybody knew him in the U.S.?
Not commercially, no. He never had a hit, never whatever. I mean, the Walker Brothers were a big UK phenomenon. I don't think most people in the US have ever even heard of them. And then Scott Walker walked away from fame. He went to a monastery and started studying Gregorian chants. And boy, he wasn't kidding. He just got sick of the music industry. But Jacques Brel and the stuff he was doing got Walker excited again by music. And he recorded four solo albums that were sort of symphonic pop. They got more a little bit out there and out there, each one, but they were still within the mainstream to a degree, very critically acclaimed and certain success in the UK. But then he walked away again, and then he came back in the 80s with albums that were so out there that they were just completely on the fringe of music, you know, you know, just crazy avant-garde stuff. But 1984's Climate of Hunter, maybe the lowest selling album in Virgin Records history, you know, and yet beloved by David Bowie, who produced a film about Walker, Tom York of Radiohead, Brian Eno, Damon Albarn of Blur, Talk Talk, who we talked about a few weeks ago. Lots of people were inspired by this guy. He did great, cool stuff. A number of other solo albums followed that 1984 comeback. Some of them really cool, like Tilt. I really like that one. He was like Leonard Cohen mixed into avant-garde surrealism. And, you know, he just did the score to Vox Lux with Natalie Portman. So an active guy who did a number of scores, lots of great music for 40, 50 years now. Very influential, far more than his album sales would ever indicate.
Well, we also have some email from listeners. You can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And that's what Robert Briggs did. He emailed dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Do you want to read what he wrote, or do you want me to?
You too.
Okay, you too. No, it's not you too. It was Robert Briggs. But
Bono did not write to us.
Correct. He writes, "Hi, Sperling and Michael. I'm listening to the latest episode of your podcast and wanted to urge you to reconsider your position that National Geographic and or Fox should have released details of the findings of their investigation into Mr. Tyson if they ultimately decided not to discipline or fire him. As you may have seen reiterated by Andrew McCabe on his publicity rounds for his book, it is the standard of law enforcement that if they open an investigation into you and that investigation does not yield sufficient evidence for an indictment, they do not then make a public showing of what they did find. The file is closed and that person's reputation is spared. The alternative is Jim Comey holding a press conference to criticize Hillary Clinton while ultimately confirming the FBI found no actual crime they could pursue. While this was not a law enforcement process, it seems the same standard should apply. As long as the process was transparent and thorough to the satisfaction of those involved, I don't see a compelling interest that entitles the public to those details. I love your podcast and listen every week. Please keep up the great work. Best, Robert Briggs." And Robert, thank you for writing.
Yeah, thank you very much for writing in. It's awesome to hear that you listen to the show regularly. That means a lot to us. I feel like we already know the dirty, tawdry details of Neil deGrasse Tyson. So I don't feel like I'm asking for them to say, "I want to know the dirt. I want to know what, you know, the naughty stuff." I want to know just what they did in terms of, were they investigating his behavior at work? Did they go into his private life? I feel like his name has been muddied, and I think they would be going more to clear it.
That's what I wanted to see, was something that really. If you're saying, "Nope, we did an investigation and we're putting him back on the air," fine, really clear his name then. If you think putting him on the air is clearing his name, there's still a little black mark there.
I feel like there's a cloud over him, and I feel like I would just simply like to know something as minimal as, We investigated his behavior at work and here in National Geographic, and we have found no complaints, though we always welcome and are open to anybody coming forward. We have urged that and found nothing of any nature to criticize about his behavior at work and his professional life. There is no ongoing legal issues in his private life, and therefore we are, I feel like that would clarify to me exactly what they did. Right now, it seems this mysterious black box. And my desire, again, is not to hear tawdry details or have them say, well, we're letting him work, but he's a bad man, shaking his finger like James Comey did. I just kind of want to know, what did they do?
What you're saying is, as Robert kind of points out, as long as the process was transparent, and what you're saying is, I don't feel like it really was that transparent.
Yeah, but it's an interesting point. It does make me want to, I appreciate the idea. Hey, we looked into it. There's nothing. He's back at work. Move on with your life. Okay. I can appreciate that sentiment and that idea. I don't know if that's what's best for Neil deGrasse Tyson, but as you say, since he hasn't said anything, maybe he's happy too. In which case, if he's happy, I'm happy. I guess the women as well, but let's not forget that.
And that's why Robert Briggs mentioned satisfaction of those involved.
Yes, exactly.
But we hope you're satisfied and happy with this week's episode of Showbiz Sandbox.
It was rushed. I feel like we were caffeinated because you got a business call. I felt we were very stumbly, but we do our best.
It's the week before CinemaCon. I'm barely holding on here. Now, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can rate and review our show. You can subscribe to our show. You won't miss an episode. Helps us out when you rate and review the show. It helps others find the show. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter @showbizsandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox is where our page can be found. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found online, and every week he's got a new and exciting website for us. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's more like appletvminus.com.
And I wonder if that domain is already taken, because I'm sure somebody has actually registered Apple TV Plus or Apple TV Minus.
Well, Apple has certainly done that.
Good point. If you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com to know what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until 2 weeks from now,
oh,
play nice.